Hello and welcome. It is Eric Erickson here. Welcome to the program. If you'd like to be a part of it, 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. More than welcome to have you chime in today. Well, it went as everyone kind of expected. You know, interestingly enough, I got a lot of criticism yesterday from, well, first of all, let me pause. Millie, not Miley. I'm sorry. Thank you to the 2.5 billion of you who sent me polite emails and said it's Millie, not Miley. For general, we'll get to General Millie here shortly. But let's talk about the California recall. I thought it was interesting. I guess not really surprising, but interesting. Yesterday, I got a lot of criticism from listeners generally. And from those who are actually in politics and run campaigns, a lot of praise. There are a real divide between those who run campaigns and I guess general spectators of politics on making the California recall about Larry Elder. My point yesterday was that there was a moment in the polling where it looked like a 50-50 shot at recalling Gavin Newsom. The moment it became about Larry Elder and not about Gavin Newsom was the moment Gavin Newsom won. Yesterday just ratified that Newsom was winning. It's notable. The margin was big enough. No one screaming about electoral fraud or stolen elections or anything like that. It was legit, and he won. And we'll get into the ramifications here. But I gotta reiterate this, though, and I know some of you disagree because you've told me politely, thank you. No, nobody vehemently disagreeing with me. Just disrespectful, or not disrespectful, disagreeing on the point very respectfully that Larry Elder should be able to pull this off. But, you know, you and I look at a candidate like Larry Elder and say, well, he checks all of our boxes for us. He's conservative. He's fiscally conservative. He's socially conservative. He's well-spoken, well-known, charismatic. He should do it, except that doesn't sell in California. California is not Oklahoma, it's not Ohio, it's not Florida, it's not Georgia, it's not North Carolina. California is California. And you got to have, frankly, you've got to have someone who is socially liberal to run in California. They can be fiscally conservative in California. Arnold Schwarzenegger, for example, very socially liberal, but was perceived, whether he was or not, as a fiscal conservative to rein in the state's financial mess. And the moment Elder made it about himself, and by the way, I have to say, I do think he did. And privately, behind the scenes, people say, yes, it was a strategic mistake for a new candidate, that he took the bait. He wanted to talk about himself. He wanted to act like he was the guy who was running against Gavin Newsom. He portrayed himself. It wasn't just the media trying to do it. Larry Elder himself became the guy who would challenge and take out Gavin Newsom. It became a gubernatorial campaign for Larry Elder, not a recall. The problem is Larry Elder may be on the radio all over California for a conservative audience, but he's not a candidate who can capture people outside of the Republican base, and the Republican base in California is tiny at this point. They've all fled the state, and now more will if they're smart. They will get out of Dodge as quickly as they can. And this, by the way, I don't mean this disparagingly or disrespectfully to Larry Elder. It's just the dynamic of California. It is a highly socially progressive state. I would note that Larry Hogan and Charlie Baker are two Republicans who have mastered getting elected in deep blue states. Maryland and Massachusetts are inarguably liberal states. Massachusetts inarguably is more liberal than California based on the data. And yet they've elected Charlie Baker a Republican. Why? Because he is very socially liberal, but he's fiscally conservative. So he checks the box for upper-income white progressives who dominate Massachusetts politics, that he's not going to bankrupt the state, but he's also not going to try to carry out a pro-life agenda. In California, a lot of people who would otherwise be inclined to vote Republican do so on pocketbook issues, not on social issues. They want to be able to kill their kids, but not have the state go bankrupt, and they're not going to vote for a guy like Larry Elder. So if the race in California stayed on Gavin Newsom and everyone focused on Gavin Newsom and made it about Gavin Newsom's double standards and Gavin Newsom's hypocrisies, Gavin Newsom would have lost. But it's not just that the media tried to make it about Larry Elder. It's that Larry Elder allowed them to make it about himself. And he went on Fox constantly. And I love Fox. I was a Fox contributor. I still go on Fox. But if you're running as a Republican in California, you don't go on Fox all the time. Why? Because even if you rally 100% of the Republican base to turn out, there are not enough of them to recall Gavin Newsom. You've got to do California media, some of which leans progressive. And Elder, to my knowledge, and based on what I have read and what people on the ground in California have told me, did not engage with California media in the way he did Fox News. So that set Newsom up to win. And there are a lot of Republicans behind the scenes today grousing about it, that Elder blew a shot that Kevin Falconer had. Now, I don't know Kevin Falconer. I've never met him. He strikes me as someone I could not vote for. He is very much a progressive social Republican, and I'm not socially progressive at all. I'm a card-carrying member of an evangelical Christian church. I go to seminary, and I think abortion is killing kids. So I couldn't support it. I don't support people who support abortion rights, and I couldn't support him. But he, behind the scenes, flew under the radar for months on end and made the case for the recall and assumed that it would be a walk in the park for him to get in until Larry Elder came in, who is, and I know this because I've been reaching out for myself, growing this show, reaching out to program directors across California, different radio stations, say, hey, I'm here. If you want content, need content, just consider it. I give the show away for free. You don't have to pay me. You don't have to fill out an affidavit. You don't have to run a bunch of extra commercials. You got extra space. I'd be financially beneficial for your station. And I was impressed with the number of stations across California Larry Elder's on. He has very high name ID among conservative talk radio listeners who are also tend to be Fox News viewers. The problem is there just aren't enough of them in California. Now, while we're all focused on California, though, there is another race out there you should keep in mind. Mike Bousselot, I think that's how you pronounce his name, he won a special election in Iowa. This is from USA Today. Republican Mark Bousselot won a special election for the Iowa House on Tuesday, keeping a competitive district under Republican control. He led Andrea Phillips Tuesday night, 51.6% to 48.3%, with all the precincts reporting a 377-vote difference. Bousselot, 38, is a former advisor and chief of staff to Governor Terry Branstad. He later served as director of Iowa Department of Management under Governor Kim Reynolds. He's got a degree from the University of Iowa and Drake University Law School. Reynolds called the election following the death of Representative John Landon a Republican. Now, here's the key here. This was a special election in an Iowa state legislative district. The key here to pay attention is that unlike California, this was a very, very, very swingy district, and the Republicans were able to pick it up. That's actually a good sign for the GOP. There's some polling out right now that the Republicans are way more competitive in Virginia than the Virginia Democrats had hoped. What's his name? Who's running? Who just doesn't seem to want to take a serious issue on anything. He's just running a very Mitt Romney campaign of "I'm a nice guy. Please don't ask me what I stand for." Glenn Youngkin. He's the polling seems to show him narrowing with Terry McAuliffe in the run-up to the election in November. There, Virginia has its gubernatorial election this year, and it can kind of be a harbinger for what happens in the following year with Republicans and Democrats in Washington. It tends to serve as an early indicator for the president's party if there's a warning sign, like, for example, George W. Bush and Barack Obama both saw the Virginia governor's mansion flip to the other party, came to be a warning sign for them. They better get their butt in gear. And in fact, Terry McAuliffe yesterday was on an Amtrak train, seen talking on the phone, not wearing a mask, and it became yet another example of the elite not doing what they should do. That gets me back to California. Newsom very notoriously went to the French Laundry, a wonderful restaurant in Northern California that is highly regarded around the world, Michelin star, went for a birthday. I believe Thomas Keller, the chef, highly regarded, world-renowned chef, runs the French Laundry, and it was his birthday, if I remember right, and Newsom was there celebrating with a bunch of other people, not wearing masks, at a time the whole state was locked down. And then Newsom's kids were seen at a summer event not wearing masks, at, like a summer camp, when Newsom had ordered summer camps around the state to wear masks. And these were not the only infractions that Newsom had that showed him to be an elite who didn't think the rules applied to him. And this is, I think, a Republican criticism that will have legs, but couldn't have legs in California, given it became Larry Elder versus Gavin Newsom. In New York, you saw the Met the other night did their fundraiser. $30,000 a ticket is where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez showed up with her Tax the Rich dress. There was the optics of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez maskless, having a masked servant lift up her dress behind her as she walked is pretty telling. Seeing all these celebrities glad-handing, pretty telling. They had an event yesterday in the House of Representatives where all the Democratic members of the House came in. They were to talk about masking in public, and they walked in, realized the cameras were already rolling, and they all had to quickly gather together, put their masks on. The mayor of Washington, D.C., a Democrat, has pretty much said that the mask mandate doesn't apply to her and her city council. She's been photographed multiple times at events without a mask on, surrounded by maskless people, even as she's threatening to arrest people who aren't wearing masks. There is a double standard between the elite and the rest of us. They don't have to wear masks. Why do we? Why does Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez get to go to a $30,000 a plate event without a mask, and your kindergartner has to go to school and wear a mask, when the science says a kindergartner does not need to wear a mask? By the way, the science does say that. Kindergartners don't need masks. There is going to be a growing backlash, and this, my friends, gets to the problem with the Democrats and the California recall. Yes, they want a recall in California, a state where if Larry Elder won the recall and then stood for election next year, he would immediately lose to a Democrat. There is going to be a gubernatorial election in California next year. Larry Elder, had he somehow managed to pull off the recall because of low turnout, there's no way he would have lasted more than a year, because California doesn't elect Republicans statewide. It's that simple. There are some states you can't win if you're a conservative Republican. There are some states you can't win if you're a progressive Democrat. We all know this. It shouldn't come as a surprise to any of us. But I kind of hope what the Democrats are going to do is they're going to look at Newsom's recall rebuff and say, you know what, by God, we should double down on masks and we should lock down our states again. Because, I mean, Gavin wasn't punished for it. We're not going to be punished for it. The people love it. 45% of voters in California said they appreciated Newsom's efforts to fight COVID. 45%. That's not a majority. Now, it was a plurality. The rest either they didn't or they didn't know, but that's not a majority of people who supported his efforts. The Democrats always are, the Republicans and Democrats alike always overplay their hands based on what the other side does. And I just have the sneaking suspicion, part of it is wishful thinking and hope, that the Democrats are going to now overplay their hand. They're going to see what happened to Newsom and say there were no consequences for what he did. We think he took the right approach. So engage, do this. Let's go back into lockdowns. Let's do vaccine mandates. Let's do mandatory masks, even outside. And around the country, you're going to see Democratic politicians do this. And here's a tip. This is a tip for all of you Democrats listening right now. California is California. California is not Michigan. It is not Wisconsin. It is not Virginia. It is not New Hampshire. It is not Maine. Hell, it's not even Washington State or Nevada. California is uniquely California. And what worked for voters in California, what voters in California were willing to tolerate, does not mean they will tolerate it in these other states. And Democrats seem to miss that. Democrats have long had it in their head that if it works in California, it's going to work everywhere else, in large part because Democrats have for a very long time, through departments of education, like they pushed a left-wing agenda that they first adopted in California. And California has such buying power, it can use that buying power to influence the textbooks in other states and the policies in other states, environmental policies and the like. And Democrats are thinking, we're going to impose this now on everyone else because we believe it. It works. Now we've got credibility. We're not getting hurt in the polls. Well, the midterms are coming. And I don't think it's going to help them to do these things, but I think they're too oblivious to realize that they really support this stuff. And remember what I always say, know when you're in the minority, even when you think you're right. Democrats think they're in the majority on this stuff, and it's going to blow back on them in the midterms. Hi there. The phone number, if you'd like to be on the call, on the show, if you want to be on the call, if you want to be on the show, 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. You know, this gets into the nature of people. If nothing else, I know people. Not I know people and have contact, but I know human nature to a degree, because this is me kind of the way a lot of people are. When you tell people they got to do something, you're probably not going to do it. I remember when I got to college, I thought, you know what? I am an adult now. I'm in college. You can't tell me what to do. I'll stay up all night. I'll do my homework. I'll make my grades, but I'll do whatever I want to do. You can't tell me what to do. In my first year in college, I was required to go on a weekend outing as part of a class, and I despised everything about it. And I was as defiant as I could. They would want me to do, it was like trust falls and crap. And I'm like, nope, not going to do it. I have no desire to do this. There is no way. I was defiant. Just to exert some level of independence. And the data seems to be growing that a vaccine mandate, even by employers, is having the effect of making some people dig in their heels. And I am that personality. I am that type of person. You can't tell me what to do. I am a grown person. I can make up my mind for myself. You're not going to bully me into it. And if anything, some people, they're doing it and they're becoming deeply resentful, and it's probably gonna harm work productivity as well. And I am encountering more and more people than I ever expected to encounter who tell me basically the same story. I was going to go get the vaccine, and now Joe Biden has told me I have to have it. Screw him. I'm not getting it. You can say it's childish or immature. I say it's human nature. I say it was the foreseeable consequential fallout of Joe Biden doing what he did. It is obvious to me that this is going to happen. It is obvious to me that this is where we would be. And yet, Democrats seem to think, well, then if they get it, let them die. So much for universal access to healthcare. We're going to put the chain smoker with lung cancer ahead of the guy who got COVID because he didn't get vaccinated. This is so logical. How did politicians, and by the way, here's what I think is actually going on. This gets back to the recall to some degree, and Gavin Newsom doing stuff that he wouldn't let other people do, and same thing happening with other politicians. I think that the elite in this country are in such a bubble, they think everyone thinks and behaves like them, and they have lost touch with the people they govern. I do. I think that there is a political elite in this country. They have been in power for a very long time in various ways, shapes, and forms. They are surrounded in a bubble with like-minded people, and they have forgotten how working, everyday, ordinary Americans live their lives and think. And ordinary, everyday, salt-of-the-earth Americans can be persuaded to take a vaccine to save their fellow neighbor, if not themselves. But they will not be bullied into doing it. And Joe Biden's approach and the approach of most Democrats is to shame and bully people. And I just, that's a huge party foul in my mind. And it was totally predictable that the outcome would be a whole lot of people refusing to be bullied and now refusing to get vaccinated. Maybe they should rethink this before carrying it out. But I don't think they have any humility to be able to say, oops, maybe we got it wrong. All right, y'all will get a laugh out of this. So what I spend my time during commercial break doing these days is I've been emailing different program directors, different stations around the country, and just said, hey, you know, my show is now available for syndication. A lot of radio shows, you use a syndicator. That syndicator sends it to a station and then tells the station, you must play our commercials or you must pay us money. And I just say, here, take it for free. If you don't play the commercials because you got breaking news or bad weather or something, all right, don't worry about it. And making it as easy as possible for people to take it. And so I'm going through and I got my assistant was going to help me do this. I was like, well, I got to go in and look and see, is this a station that does the sort of talk radio I do? Do they do syndication? what's their genre? Is it a station I want to be? So I just clicked through. I was like, oh, I'll somebody recommended the station in Michigan. I'll go click and see and realize who is their big voice? Al Sharpton. I think I'll pass. Yep. Not going to be doing that one. I've been on his TV show before on MSNBC. It was like five against one. It was me against these five people, Al and these four, and each of them was even more and more to the left. I was like, wow. I mean, you people are completely disconnected from reality. Well, we got to get into General Milley. It is General Milley. Yesterday, I said General Miley, and 2.3 billion or so people emailed, direct messaged, private messaged, instant messaged to let me know that it is General Milley. It's not Miley like Miley Cyrus. It's Milley like Milley Vanilli. So General Milley reached out to the Chinese, told the Chinese that if Donald Trump wanted to attack them, that he would tip them off. Now, there is some news today that sets this in a slightly different light if this is true. And I caveat this with if this is true, because it does change things. To say this, according to some press reports, General Milley did not act alone, but acted on behalf of the then Secretary of Defense, Esper. If that's true, then he was following the civilian chain of command. Still doesn't make it good, but puts it in a different light that the Secretary of Defense himself wanted him to help. Here is a senior defense official tells Josh Rogan at the Washington Post and Axios, Jonathan Swan, that Milley was absolutely not going rogue. Secretary Esper took the initiative on this in October. Esper asked his own policy folks to backchannel the message. Milley's message followed Esper's. Now, this comes with some reporting from Jonathan Swan. Jonathan Swan is probably the best reporter in Washington, D.C. right now. And I want to follow this. Some of Milley's friends are cringing over Milley's extensive and high-profile scenes in a number of books beyond Peril, Bob Woodward's new book. Republicans are already aggravated with him. Extensive direct quotes attributed to Milley have led Republicans to accuse him of personally leaking to authors. And I do believe that's the case, by the way. Now, the biggest, most explosive part is Milley reportedly assured the Chinese general, his counterpart there, that Donald Trump would not attack China, and that Trump did decide to attack, Milley would give his Chinese counterpart a secret heads up. Milley has not responded. Marco Rubio has already released a statement saying, quote, General Milley has attempted to rationalize his reckless behavior by arguing that what he perceived as the military's judgment as more stable than its civilian commander, it sets a dangerous precedent. Now, here's where I got to read for you what Jonathan Swan writes, because it does put Milley's actions in a different light, that it was not him acting unilaterally without any sort of civilian input. In mid-October 2020, top Pentagon officials grew concerned about intelligence they'd seen. It showed the Chinese were consuming their own intelligence that had made them concerned about the possibility of a surprise U.S. attack against China. Three sources familiar with the situation tell Axios. One of the sources said, quote, I think the Chinese were getting bad intelligence, a combination of wag the dog conspiracy thinking and bad intel from bad sources. Then Defense Secretary Mark Esper, that's Trump Secretary of Defense, worried the Chinese were misreading the situation and that their misperception could lead to a conflict nobody wanted. Esper directed his policy office to issue a back-channel message to the Chinese to reassure them the U.S. had no intention of seeking a military confrontation. The message, Don't overread what you're seeing in Washington. We have no intention to attack. Let's keep lines of communication open. These back channel communications were handled a couple of levels below Esper, one of the sources said. U.S. officials involved thought the Chinese received the initial message well. Milley followed up later in the month with a call to his Chinese counterpart to reiterate the message, two of the sources confirmed. It's unclear whether anyone at the Pentagon told President Trump or the White House what they were doing. Around the same time Esper learned of the Chinese concerns, he also learned that a long-planned deployment to Asia had been moved up a couple weeks earlier than previously planned to accommodate COVID quarantine protocols. Esper told colleagues the last thing the Chinese needed to see at the moment, when they were already misreading Washington's intention, were more planes, according to one of the sources. Esper went so far as to delay this long-planned exercise in Asia until after the election to lower the temperature. Axios has not independently confirmed that Milley told his Chinese counterpart he would give him a heads up if the U.S. planned to attack China. One source familiar with Milley's conversations with the Chinese counterpart would only broadly characterize them as Milley saying something to the effect of, "We'll both know if we're going to war. That's not going to be a surprise attack, and there's no reason for you to do a preemptive strike." Now, let me go beyond this and also tell you that Bob Menendez, who is the Senate chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, he is a Democrat. He is threatening to subpoena the Secretary of Defense and other officials if they don't show up in person for hearings before the Senate. This has escalated over Afghanistan and Milley's role in Afghanistan. And I need to lay out a few thoughts for you here. Let's take Jonathan Swan. And Jonathan Swan, you should know, at Axios, has the best sources in Washington. If Jonathan Swan reports that Mike Esper, Donald Trump's Secretary of Defense, asked General Milley to reach out to his Chinese counterpart, and Esper is the one who delayed the war games or the practice, whatever it was, in the South China Sea. If Esper's the one who did all of that, then Milley was following orders from civilians, and Milley can't be fired, didn't commit treason or any of that, if his sources are true. And knowing Jonathan Swan and his reporting, and that he has multiple sources, and that he's highly regarded by the right and the left in Washington as an honest broker, I think we can conclude that his reporting is fair and accurate. And it was Mike Esper, the Secretary of Defense for Donald Trump, who was trying to defuse the situation with China, and Mark Milley was the guy who had to make the phone calls and do it. Now, I need you to put a period on that thought and move over to this thought. Woodward and Costa's book comes out. Woodward and Costa's book is called Peril. It details secret moves by the high-ranking military officers handling national security in the transition between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. It documents that Milley holds Joe Biden to a different standard than he held Donald Trump. But this is the most important part. The book hasn't come out yet. I'm sure everyone will race to buy it. This is all part of the buzz and buildup of the book. They sensationalize it. But as portrayed in the Washington Post, and this is a point that can't be understated, as portrayed and described in the Washington Post, Bob Woodward's own newspaper, Milley is portrayed as doing this unilaterally and on his own. Milley is portrayed as the hero for the left. Mike Esper is not mentioned in the Washington Post. Mike Esper is not described as the guy who was involved. Mike Esper is not is someone who's giving direction to General Milley in the Washington Post account. It's not there. I've gone back. I've looked multiple times. There is no attribution to the Secretary of Defense ordering Milley to do this. It's Milley on his own. It is well known, it is not a secret, it is not even up for debate that Mark Milley, the general, is a source for this stuff. Milley has been blabbing to multiple authors about his time with Donald Trump. And it seems that Milley is trying to make himself the protagonist and trying to make himself the hero. And that right there is all sorts of trouble. If Mark Milley did what the Secretary of Defense asked him to do, defuse the situation with China, it appears we're worried about it. And this is key here. The intelligence that we have is China. We are worried China thinks we're going to attack them. Therefore, China, based on its intelligence, may launch a preemptive strike against us. We need to defuse the situation and make sure they know everything's okay in our country. Let's reach out and reassure them. That is a perfectly legitimate, valid thing to do. And no sane person can dispute that it is a good thing to defuse a situation with China when our sourcing tells us the Chinese intelligence is bad, but the Chinese believe they're bad intelligence, that Donald Trump may want to attack them. We need to defuse the situation so they don't try to jump the gun and surprise attack us or invade Taiwan. We need to do that as a country. It's smart. It's sound. It's good to do. The problem is that in Mark Milley's telling of it to Bob Costa, to Robert Costa and Bob Woodward, that isn't what happened. According to the excerpts we have thus far, and maybe the full book will provide that it was actually done at Esper's behest, but in the telling that we have in the Washington Post, it's Mark Milley himself deciding he himself is going to undermine his commander-in-chief with no civilian input, and he puts himself in as the hero and protagonist of the moment. That's bad. And what it tells me is that even if Mark Milley followed orders from a civilian and helped defuse a situation that could have turned bad quickly, Mark Milley views himself as an indispensable man and wants to couch himself for posterity as the hero of the moment. And that means his ego is too big. He's too much of a politician and he needs to be fired because it makes him sound like he is above the civilian chain of command. It makes it sound like he thinks he is and will operate as if he is, even if he doesn't. We don't need someone of that ego in that position. Now there's a twist. Bob Menendez, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is a war hawk, is not a fan of withdrawing from Afghanistan, and is out for blood in the Biden administration. Milley abandoned Bagram Air Force Base. He believed that the military had to abandon Bagram Air Force Base and leave all of our supplies and materials and hardware and weaponry behind in order to shore up the airport in Kabul. It didn't go well. It didn't go as planned, and it made extracting people from Afghanistan worse. I would not be surprised if the Biden administration decides to make Mark Milley the fall guy for Afghanistan now. I mean, he played a role. He is complicit in the role. He played that role. And he hasn't helped himself in his hearings before Congress on all the woke nonsense. So make him the fall guy and force him out. It's a win-win for Biden. He gets a scapegoat for Afghanistan, and he gets to placate Republicans who are angry about this. It's smart politics for Biden to make Milley the fall guy at this point. And Milley's ego clearly needs a comeuppance. My buddy Dan McLaughlin writes his baseball crank on Twitter, writes over at National Review. He put this up. He said, to Mark Milley, the General Lee who has been dead for 151 years is a dire threat, but the General Lee who commands the world's largest army on behalf of a murderous tyranny is a chum. That's a problem. Yes, it is a problem. The fact that Mark Milley tried to play buddy-buddy with his Chinese communist counterpart and make himself out to be the hero is fundamentally a problem here. The Democrats can defend him all they want, and it now appears, based on Jonathan Swan's reporting, it was actually Mike Esper, the Secretary of Defense, who ordered all of this, but the fact that Milley took Esper out of the equation and claimed it was his own idea and he did it and bypassed civilian chain of command is all the reason you need to make him go. If the Biden administration decides to make him the fall guy for Afghanistan and get him out, the point is he needs to be gotten out. I was going to get to the story yesterday, and then the Mark Milley stuff all hit the fan, and I had to bypass it, but it is too good not to bring up. Pramila Jayapal is one of the hyper-progressive Democrats in Congress. Let me just read you the this is the title and subtitle at BuzzFeed. Title: She's one of Congress's leading progressives, just not in her own office, staffers say. Subtitle, former staffers who worked for Representative Pramila Jayapal, a House Democrat who built her reputation on being a champion of workers, says her treatment of her staff was often inconsistent with her public image. Last fall, Representative Jayapal introduced the Paycheck Recovery Act aimed at curbing layoffs during the pandemic by having the federal government pay people salaries. Publicly, Jayapal contended that passing the bill was a matter of survival for workers, but privately, former staffers said the lawmaker acted very differently. In November of 2020, she laid off two staffers without severance. Two people familiar with the incident told BuzzFeed News. Chris Evans, a spokesperson for Jayapal, said the decision to consolidate was made to best utilize office resources, and the staffers were given 6 weeks' notice. But one staff member who was told they were being laid off was invited to reapply for a new job in the office that would consolidate the two roles, those familiar said. The staffer was required to go through the full application process, despite the job being nearly identical to the one they'd been laid off from. And then, without advance warning, they found out in an all-hands meeting that they didn't get the job. The staffers who were let go declined to provide comment for the story. The incident upset at least four staffers in the office who spoke to BuzzFeed News. It was, they said, one of many instances in which Jayapal's interactions with her employees had run counter to the public persona she built for herself. My personal favorite one is, at times, Jayapal also grew upset with staffers over scheduling conflicts. Three sources recalled one instance in the office where she blamed a staffer for her personal weight gain because she didn't have enough time at the gym scheduled. Wow. You know what?